Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on Newstalk.
Now, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. This is Emmett Oliver in this morning for Mandy Johnson. I'll be keeping you company for the next hour as we look across a whole range of business and political stories from home and abroad. And coming up on the show, what Netflix's recruitment and indeed firing policy tells us about how to handle staff. We'll be asking about a Trump victory in the US election. How will that leave Ireland and should we be worried? And in our monthly Techscape slot, we look at the strange case of people trying to manufacture rain in the United Arab Emirates. You can, of course, email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. But first, let's kick off with the issue of recruitment and staff management at Netflix and their culture of high performance. Paul McCardle is the managing partner at thepanel.com. He also writes a column with The Currency, and he's been looking at how Netflix treats staff. You're very welcome along to Taking Stock, Paul.
Delighted to be here. Thank you very much for the invite.
No problem. Now, Netflix, we all know them. They're omnipresent in our lives. They're on our screen. They're all over sort of devices. It's a brand that's just, it's so powerful at this stage and has become like that over the last few years. Less written about what their HR policies are like. Can you just talk us through how they do it differently and things that would be maybe unusual for an Irish audience?
Netflix, it's a great company to study, whether you're a HR professional or a business owner or you're managing staff in any way. The way they do things is quite unique. So they were a startup. They originally were posting DVDs. They tried to get Blockbuster to buy them. Blockbuster didn't see a future for them. And then they went into streaming services. And what happened by the fact they were a startup is they could make up rules as they went along. And there's been a few books that have been written about Netflix Emmett. Patty McCord, their HR director, has written a really good book. And this book, No Rules Rules, which I've covered in the article in The Currency, is by Reed Hastings, who's the MD of Netflix, and Aaron Meyer, who's an INSEAD professor of culture. And the book concentrates on how Netflix does things and how they do things differently from a cultural perspective.
So could you give us maybe just two or three examples of how they might be quite different from an orthodox Irish company and how they manage their staff?
So what was very interesting in Netflix, they took a decision, for example, that people who are performing just fine or not that well at all, they decided to get rid of them.
The average worker.
The average worker, Emmett. And then what happened was they found the productivity had actually gone up. So they felt that the better talent that was there, their talent density of hiring much better people, that kicked that off. So with that view that they aren't going to hire the best, they, from a compensation point of view, they'd pay market or above to get the best talent. And then how that talent was empowered in Netflix is different from how it's done from other companies. And this is something that has developed over the years. So, for example, we are used to, in Ireland, managing business from a hierarchical perspective, MD down. In Netflix, Emmett, they do it from the bottom up. So it's the book covers the changes in how Netflix do business and the cultural aspects to that.
Yeah, and they talk about star performers and, you know, as you say, taking away some people that are just plodding along, as we would call them in Ireland. Obviously, I suppose it's slightly different for two reasons. One, you know, the industrial relations laws in California are very different to what we could do here. So people listening will be saying, well, we can't do that even if we want to do it. But I suppose secondly is they're a very fast growing company. So they have the checkbook there, I suppose, to spend the money and pay above premium, as you've said. So that made life a bit easier for them, I suppose.
Correct. And also they were expanding in international markets at the time. So you're right, Emmett, that they had the scope there. What is very interesting then from the talent density perspective is that a manager or leader in Netflix is meant to give their team context in making decisions. So the best example is they had a guy, a junior enough guy, who was responsible for buying sports documentaries. And he heard about this documentary called Icarus, which is about the Russian doping scandal. And it quickly became apparent that there's going to be an auction for this. And is going to be set for a record price. Now, in an Irish context, or most normal context, that goes through 4 or 5, up to MD, back down again. In Netflix, he was told to do what he thought was best for the business. And he ended up spending $4.6 million, a junior guy. And that's the way that they work.
So it's a very flat structure and people are given responsibility maybe beyond their strict title and so on.
Absolutely. And you've picked a great word there in freedom, because they have an F and R policy, Emmett, and that's freedom and responsibility. So the freedom of somebody like that guy to go and being able to buy that program, but the responsibility to do what's right for Netflix. So no rules, rules. That title's come about from originally, they were finding an administrative nightmare managing holidays and managing expenses. So the first thing with holidays is you as an employee make the right decision for Netflix and for yourself, but your vacancy time is unlimited.
So theoretically, and that's a big word to be using about this because it's different, but you could take off 3 months solid.
Absolutely.
There's no legal or contractual stop on that, but you're not going to do that.
Another good point, yes, because counterintuitively, people end up taking less holidays, which they actually...
Because when I first read about this, I remember a few months ago reading about this part of what Netflix does, and I always think to myself, if somebody says to you, listen, Paul, you can take as much holidays as you want, but if the guy or woman beside you never takes holidays, you might feel, I don't know if I want to be seen as the person who's always on holiday. But in a way, that's what Netflix wants you, you know, to sort of police the team in a way.
Well, they did, but the leaders, again, showing context, and this is rather than lead a context on things, then the leaders themselves would take holidays. But the situation is that you'd leave Netflix in the best place so everything is ready before you go and take that time off. But again, with expenses. So they don't record expenses in the traditional way. You make a decision through the lens of what you think is right for Netflix. So, for example, if you're flying from, say, Ireland to the States and you have a 10-hour flight, you go business class, you make that decision. You don't need anyone signed off by an
engineer. Okay, I do like this element. I was a bit a bit suspicious of the other elements, but now you're starting to talk my language.
Exactly, but if say you're meeting and going from Dublin to London and you get a limo to collect you and you're staying in the private lounge and all that, they will actually sack you for that.
Yeah, so your decision-making, it will be scrutinised and you'll stand or fall on the quality of those decisions. I suppose, did you get a sense from reading the book, is it a bit blurry so nobody really knows? Yes, it's great to give all this responsibility and sort of autonomy to staff, but is it a bit sort of like, I'm going to make this decision, but I don't know whether they're going to like it or not, and maybe that's just taking off the stabilisers on any employee, but if I get the decision wrong, I'm going to be sacked, as you say. So I know it's great to get the responsibility, but it can be a bit blurry at the same time.
So if it's blurry, and this is where Erin Meyer, the professor of culture in INSEAD, her part of the book is very important. That if it's blurry to you, Emmett, that means that your boss hasn't given you the right context.
I thought you were saying, you're fired, Emmett. You're fired. You're not getting this.
So that's the way that they would look at that. So the freedom of responsibility works very well because they've been given the context of what it means to do what's best for things. So I found in the book that it was explained very, very well. The book is split into two parts. Reed Hastings does his bit, and then Erin Meyer would look through the lens of company culture from an academic perspective.
Now, talk to me a little bit about this idea of the keeper test. This is an idea that when somebody hands in their notice, well, what happens then? Just to explain to our listeners.
I found this probably the single most fascinating piece of the book. Keeper test is very simple. If Emmett hands in his notice to News Talk, our great producer, John Fardy, has to decide...
First sentence out of his mouth would be, about time.
About time. So Emmett goes. So the question that John would need to ask himself is Emmett worth fighting for to keep? And that's what's called.
And Emmett went a bit overboard on the business class seats.
So if the answer is yes, then he fights to keep Emmett. But where Netflix take it a step further is they look at you are Netflix is you're working in a, say, professional sports team. So you're as good almost as your last game. So if John Farley thinks that Emmett's lost his mojo, and he asks himself the question, would I keep Emmett if Emmett did hand in his nose? And the answer was no, I would not. He will actually sit down with Emmett and cut a check and let Emmett go and look to get what he thinks is a better talent to replace Emmett and bring the high talent density up. So they're very proactive in managing the talent destiny to get really top performers. So the best analogy is akin to a sports team. You have a striker, you're scoring lots of goals, and all of a sudden the goals dry up.
Messi, Ronaldo, you know, yeah,
you're those transferred.
Yeah, so it's like a football team ethic, you know, in a company.
Absolutely.
The one final one I find really interesting is localization. Obviously, we don't have a big Netflix operation in Ireland, but we do have other US multinationals here. So talk to me a little bit about how they adapt this approach, because as we know, each body of law is different. The EU operates entirely different to the US labour market. So how do they kind of implement this in different places?
So in Netflix, and a big thing in the book is they speak with candor, and they would look at the ideas of their team, and they will argue about those ideas and the merits of ideas rather than make it personal about the person who's presenting the ideas. And that takes a lot of time to get that trust. They found in Japan, culturally, that was very difficult, because in Japan, they are not used to having these candid chats among themselves. They would seem to be disrespecting their colleagues if they seem to be criticising them in any way. So they had to adapt there. In Holland, the Dutch are very, very direct, even more direct than the candor in Netflix. So they had to tone down how they adapt things. So Aaron Meyer has written a fantastic book called The Culture Map, as well as co-writing this book. And in The Culture Map, where Reed Hastings saw that work, she lays out how all the different cultures react in different ways to different things. And so Netflix have used that as a basis to localise the way that they operate in different international markets.
It'd be interesting to see if they ever opened an office here, how they would meld with the peculiar Irish culture, which is to sort of talk around topics all the time and speak very inexactly, right? So that would be
inexactly
a tough challenge.
Yes, Emmett, and have meetings about meetings. So what the Culture Map does, it prepares Netflix for how different cultures would deal with that, and they'll...
You can imagine one of their employees going to the boss there saying, you're doing grand.
Yeah.
And Netflix say, well, could you just prepare to that a little bit more for us?
So grand wouldn't be a word that Netflix would ever have. And then the second thing that I would say is that prior to them opening up in Ireland, they'd be doing significant communication around culture, about how they deal with things and have people up to speed before they actually...
Yeah. Now, do you remember Jack Welch from General Electric GE?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, he used to do this sort of basically exit out 10%, to use the language that he used, 10% of the staff every year. You know, you take out the non-performers. So it's some part of that has made it into the Netflix model.
The difference with the Jack Welch, and actually, it's funny enough, it's mentioned in the book, so Emmett, that 10% seemed to be a fairly solid number.
You're saying you're going well beyond that with Netflix?
Yeah, well the thing with Netflix, it might be 3%.
It's not a number, yeah, whereas he was locked in, yeah.
And if you go and join Netflix as an employee, you're well aware before you go in the door what you're getting into, no more than your professional sports person going into sports.
If you're going to Real Madrid, you know what you're buying into. Now, you run a big company, big recruitment company, thepanel.com. It used to be panel.ie.
Yeah.
They've lost their IE. Would you be approving unlimited holidays and somebody just taking responsibility and coming back to you and saying, yeah, I brought all my pals out for a meal that cost €2,000, but, you know, I believed it was the right thing to do. Would you buy into this as somebody who's actually running a company yourself?
So my colleagues are listening intently, particularly around the holidays, Emmett.
It's not Christmas yet.
It's not Christmas. I think for the SME owners listening, the book is great to read because it gives you some ideas on what to do. I think a lot of them are very hard to implement in an SME environment. Particularly because you don't have the number of people to take the slack if other people go on unlimited
time. No, and it's a tight labour market. You might say, I don't like this person, I want them to leave, but they may not be easy to replace with someone better.
Exactly. And of course, then Netflix has spent years building up a brand name to attract that talent in the first place. But an SME owner listens to this, the book is well worth reading because you'll get some nuggets that you can help apply. For somebody in a much larger organisation, I would say there's huge value in reading it, but to tread carefully in that if you are going down the Netflix way, you have to be all in, and all in is something that's going to take a lot of time.
So when they're down in the Employment Appeals Tribunal clutching the book, we might say it didn't quite work out, but it's definitely worth reading and some interesting ideas there. Paul McArdle, thank you for talking us through it and doing the reading on behalf of our listeners. He is the managing partner at thepanel.com. Thank you very much for coming in this morning. And you are listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. And coming up next, we'll be looking about the Trump presidency and what it'll do, good or bad, for Ireland's economy. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver in for Mandy Johnson this morning. Now, the eyes of the world are on the US presidential election and have been for quite some time now since we've had Kamala Harris also entering the race. And let's be honest, it provides entertainment, if nothing else. But what would a Trump victory in particular mean for Ireland in economic terms? We know, of course, the success of the Irish economy pivots heavily around FDI. So what would some of the Trump policy proposals mean if, of course, he is victorious in November? And that's, of course, big if and all of this. And I'm delighted now to be joined by economist Dan O'Brien, and the two of us will talk away and see what we can itemise where the threats are from a Trump presidency, and there may of course be benefits as well, which we'll drop on to do. Good morning to you, Dan.
Hi there, Emmett. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. Dan, I suppose we have to get the throat clearing out of the way. We don't know who's going to win this election. We know it's probably going to be very close one way or the other, as recent US elections are tend to be. But we want to sort of gaze into the crystal ball nevertheless. We'll talk at another time maybe about what Kamala Harris might mean for Ireland. But it's the Trump presidency, I suppose, that's getting more of the interest because his proposals are more of a disruptor or more of a departure from current Biden policy proposals. Could you just walk us through maybe one or two of the big ones that you see, just maybe for our listeners' benefit, outline where you think the sort of the threat part is in the Trump policy platform?
Well, I'm actually very worried about this, and I see it as sort of a Brexit scale risk for the Irish economy, and I'm very worried that we're not preparing as we did for Brexit. Let's just give one statistic out today. That we ship more goods, four times more goods to the United States than we do to Britain in the first half. That was the first half of this year. Now, any sort of disruption of that trade is going to have a big impact on this economy. Trump has very clearly said that he's going to put an import tax on everything that comes into the United States. So once you start putting import taxes on things, the companies in Ireland that make that stuff, mostly in the pharmaceutical area, are going to have to pay a 10% tax to ship their stuff to the United States. Now, are they going to change their minds and say it's cheaper for us to avoid that tariff and produce those medicines in the United States? That's my biggest worry, that 10% tax, he introduces that, we on the European side retaliate, and we put some taxes on imports coming in from the United States, and it gets more costly and more difficult to produce in Ireland, and those producers decide they're going to shift their production to the United States. That will affect both our exports, and it will affect our corporation tax. So that, to me, is for Ireland, is the biggest worry, and Ireland is by far the biggest exporter per capita to the United States in the European Union.
Dan, the other one, I suppose, we'll come back to the tariffs in a few minutes because I suppose they're more technical in nature, but also the tax part, which is the secondary potential threat. There is Trump, he would need definitely congressional approval here, but we don't know. Congress is up for grabs too. But this is the idea of reducing corporation tax down to 15%, which would, I suppose, erode away tax advantages that Ireland currently has, where it's pretty much running a 15% minimum tax rate itself. So do you see that one as less of a threat, or as the tariffs are somewhat similar in terms of the potential impact?
So I'd see that as being less of a threat. You know, if you were to equalize, let's say corporation tax were to be the same, and there's no, as you say, that has to go through Congress. It's a much more complicated process for a further tax cut. And don't forget, during his first administration, Donald Trump did the biggest corporate tax cut in decades. So it's by no means certain that will happen. But let's just imagine it did. you have companies, American companies based here, who are booking their profits here. They've invested in lots of in plant and machinery in the pharmaceutical case. They've got staff and structures here in the tech space, for example. Would they decide, okay, we're going to disrupt everything to get the same deal in the United States? I don't see that happening. Now, over time, that might erode our advantage in terms of attracting American FDI, but it's definitely this new import tariff that really worries me. That's the biggest one that could really have a sudden change. I don't think a reduction in American corporation tax would have a dramatic sudden change. As I say, it may change the relative attractiveness of Ireland over time, but that's a much slower burning thing.
Now, the only thing that certainly personally that I would, you know, is maybe lighten the level of threat or take some of the sting out of it is a tariff of 10% on imports, as you say, everything that comes into the harbours of America, West or East Coast, you know, it's going to have a massive inflationary impact, you know, which can't be great for Donald Trump with his support base as it is. So, I mean, yes, I understand he wants to retaliate. I know he feels that America is treated unfairly in trade terms, but why you would want to increase the costs for consumers who are already reeling in the US from a whole range of inflationary increases, it would seem electorally and populist in the sense, not very populist to do that. So do you think they actually will come with these tariffs or they will get watered down? Just was feedbacks back into your other point about making a bit of a diplomatic offensive to make sure that Ireland is taken out of the pot right from the start.
Yeah, America is a very big economy and the amount of imports and exports is actually small relative to the size of its economy. So it's a quite closed economy. So you could argue that a 10% tariff on a small number of all the goods that are sold in the United States, domestically produced and then imported, it would have a limited inflationary effect. So I think he could get away with it, given how, you know, inflation in the United States has been almost 10% in within the past 2 years. I don't think he would have that sort of inflationary effect. So I think people, it could be fudged where he could impose those tariffs, say he's protecting American jobs and industry, and that you wouldn't have that much of an inflation effect. And that inflation effect, don't forget, is not going to come immediately. That would come over months and maybe a couple of years. So I think he could definitely get away with it from the inflationary perspective. Another reason I'm so worried about it, you know, take him seriously when he says things. He's been saying this for a long time. I think we really need to plan for this and plan for the European retaliation. Don't forget trade policy. We don't control our own trade policy. Brussels controls our trade policy.
Yeah, I suppose maybe there's a bit of complacency as well, because the first Trump term, you know, it was reasonably relax from an Irish Inc. point of view. You know, corporation tax still return stayed pretty solid, jobs stayed pretty solid. So I suppose, and I'm not trying to in any way nullify your argument this time around, but I suppose what might be breeding the complacency the second time around is that not a whole lot happened from an Ireland Inc. point of view the first time around. So that might be what's, you're talking about the government diplomatically and so on, not doing a whole lot that what you can see, or certainly that's visible. That may be a product of the first time the Trump presidency, from an Ireland tax base and job base point of view, it didn't really have the sting that may have been said back in 2016 by various pundits and commentators. So that might be what's behind the complacency that you're seeing.
I think that's a very good point, because, you know, Trump's bark was much worse than his bite in all sort of foreign issues, pretty much, whether it was economic policy or diplomacy during his first term. Now, I would attribute that to the chaotic nature. He wasn't prepared for government. He didn't have the people in place. This time it is radically different. There are hundreds of people being lined up to fill jobs in this administration. They are much more focused. Have a look at something called Project 2025. Okay, he has disavowed this because he didn't want controversy, he didn't want to time himself down. But these are people who have, in great detail, for every government department, huge range of policies, set out things they want to do from day one. So I think this is going to be a very different administration if he gets in for a second term. And I think you're absolutely right. Not nearly as much happened as was feared in the first term. And maybe that is the reason people are not paying enough attention to this, not planning ahead for it, not thinking about how badly it could affect both the Irish economy in the short term and our broader business model of attracting American FDI.
Now, of course, Trump has assets here. They're small enough, but nevertheless, in Clare, he also has other assets in Europe. I suppose that goes to your point that in some way the Irish government, probably the Department of Foreign Affairs, but other agencies, IDA maybe possibly would also play into this. But this idea that because Ireland is essentially hosting US companies, not as much European and very few Chinese, that the argument to be made, you're saying you're very worried about all this at the start of the interview, your argument would essentially be, look, all you're going to do if you certainly include US companies based in Ireland who would be tariffed to 10% is damage US companies. So President Trump, that's the opposite of what you're trying to do. Is that essentially what the argument that you think, from Simon Harris to the foreign affairs folk to IDA, whoever it is that makes these arguments in Washington and elsewhere, that's the type of argument you'd like to see them make. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. That basically it's in not in the American interest of American companies, and that's what keeps America strong. Now, and also the people to really best make that argument are the people in American companies themselves. So they have a massive lobbying presence in the United States, where they will no doubt be lobbying furiously around this. But, you know, I do have to say, I'd be really worried that what he's going to say is, these are American pharmaceutical companies. They are making pharmaceuticals for Americans, but they are employing Irish people. Why is that happening? Bring those jobs back here, bring the production back here. And he's not entirely wrong. From an Irish perspective, that will be very bad. But from an American perspective, you know, that is a fair point. And that is increasingly getting picked up on in the United States with economists and policy wonks that, you know, why is it that American companies are going, employing people in other countries, paying corporation tax in other countries, and then shipping the product back to the United States? Many reasonable people are saying, look, this is not in our best interests. So, you know, that argument is pretty strong. And, you know, the corporate lobbyists may not be able to persuade him to give a carve out to American pharmaceutical companies based in Ireland, because he can make the valid point, as I've just made, that it's not really in America's interests.
Yeah, but I suppose the rebuttal to that is a lot of the US multinationals are supplying, the reason they're here and other parts of Europe is to supply the European market. So I suppose, you know, just from a supply chain point of view, it's just not going to be physically possible to migrate every bit of manufacturing in the farm industry, even a large slug of it, just going back to the US East Coast or whatever. There's also supply chain reasons that they are here in Europe, not only tax reasons. So Mr. Trump and the Trump, they would have to get over that problem. That's not something that you can just wish away. There are reasons that there are manufacturing capacity throughout Europe in the pharma sector, and it's not in Boston or Detroit or whatever. Yeah, so that's a problem that he's going to have to get around.
I totally agree with you on that, because, you know, they are producing, not only they're producing for other parts of the world, particularly Europe, but Ireland is the biggest, like the American figures, import figures show, Ireland is the biggest source of pharmaceutical imports to the United States. We're bigger than, you know, the Germans and the Swiss and the traditionally big manufacturers of this product. That's not because Ireland has lots of its own firms doing this. We have some successful pharmaceutical firms, but it's mostly because American companies have taken American jobs to Ireland to make drugs for Americans. And that is a difficult argument. You know, it's, as I say, Trump has a point. And all those people who say, why is this happening? They want to change things. That is going to be a very difficult argument to counter if this comes into onto the radar.
Yeah, I suppose, as you said earlier, both of us agreed that the argument to be made is you're damaging US companies here by this proposal, unless there's some kind of carve-out, which personally I think there could very well be, but that's just mine. Let me just bring the conversation to an end, Dan. In terms of, obviously, this is based on all positive, and the word if is doing a lot of work here. Obviously, we have a very strong Democratic ticket as well, who are gaining in a lot of swing states at the moment. I don't know as much about the Harris-Waltz plan, because we haven't really have it itemized. It is expected to be so in the next few days, like the economic platform of that side. I suppose to give our listeners a bit more of a relaxed air from this particular conversation, I would expect the Democrats to be a little bit more pretty much more continuity with the current policy, certainly in contrast to the Trump administration that we might be seeing. Would you agree with that?
Totally. You know, I think it's very unclear. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal just this week looking at the economic policy and the debate within the Harris team as to how much detail to go into. General view seems to be don't tie themselves down too much. Don't give too much detail. But one would expect, given that the people involved in her team have been involved in Democratic politics for a while, that we wouldn't get any sudden changes if she were to win, that there would be, she is definitely the continuity candidate. But I would say at the same time, I think people, you know, who aren't plugged into the US need to be aware that, you know, both sides of the aisle in the United States have become much more anti-globalization, skeptical of free trade, in favor of protectionism. And, you know, I think that's a long-term trend that's taking place. And I think that's going to have an impact over time, regardless of which party is in power. And I see no reason why that trend would reverse anytime soon. There's a deep view in the United States that opening up to trade with China in particular was the cause of their Rust Belt problems and their deindustrialization. Even though that's wrong, in my view, that's deeply believed on both sides of the aisle. So I think we need to sort of be prepared for a less open, less pro-globalization America, regardless of who's in the presidency.
Sure, and that's a bigger conversation, as you say. We don't have, unfortunately, time to give it today, but a very interesting conversation about the presidential election. We'll keep an eye on the Harris-Walz plan as well. We've done a lot on Trump in this particular conversation because that's where the bigger threat is, hence we're alighting on that particular topic. For now, thank you very much. Dan O'Brien, who's Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs, thank you for joining us on Taking Stock. You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk, and I'm Emmett Oliver. After the break, we go cloud busting. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver in for Mandy Johnson this morning. Now it's time for this.
Techscape on Taking Stock. Brought to you by PwC. Our industry experts can help you unlock the full potential of AI to transform your business safely and responsibly. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
Now, this next story reads like a horror story mixed with a little bit of science fiction. If you were a country, imagine how powerful you could be if you were able to make and manufacture rain. Yes, you've heard that right. This is what the United Arab Emirates is attempting to do. And my next guest travelled there to witness some of the ways that they are attempting to do it. And it's great to welcome Amit Karwala, who is a writer and editor at Wired, to Taking Stock. Good morning to you.
Morning.
Now, the amazing thing about, we know how dry this part of the world is. We know it's very, very arid. We know the climate there is very different to us here in Europe. And I'm sure there's upsides to that. And then there are certain downsides. But before we get into what they're trying to do, just explain a little bit about the technology to me and what exactly is cloud seeding.
So cloud seeding tries to basically extract more rain from the atmosphere. So a problem that they have in the UAE and other arid areas is that there's lots of, well, there's some water vapor in the sky, but it's not, the droplets aren't big enough for them to actually fall as rain. So it's not enough to have water in the sky. It actually has to coalesce into droplets that are big enough, heavy enough to fall as rain. So what cloud seeding tries to do is make those water droplets stick together by spraying chemicals or salt or other particles into the sky to attract water vapor in the hope that it then makes the water heavy enough so that it falls to the ground as rain.
Now, when I hear something like spraying something into the atmosphere, obviously the distances and size and scale of all of this must be massive. So is this a huge resource that they need to have to sort of stimulate this rain?
So the way they do it at the moment is they send up planes. So they have a fleet of planes that they will then send up. So they kind of have a team of people that will scour the radar maps looking for clouds that are suitable for seeding. And then when they find one of those clouds, they'll scramble one of their pilots in one of these planes, and they'll fly, the pilot will fly up to the base of the cloud, and then on the wings of their planes there are flares attached which will release salt crystals into the base of the cloud when they're ignited. So each flight costs about $8,000. They're doing maybe 100 flights a year. So it's not insanely expensive in the grand scheme of things when you consider some of the other things that have been funded in the UAE.
I was about to say, is this per drop, you know, was what I was thinking when you said that.
Yeah,
can I just ask you,
dollars per flight, so you can maybe get three or four clouds on that flight.
In terms of this technology itself, obviously you've explained it very well and very simply. Is this sort of in any way a piece of technology that's in any way accredited, or is it signed off or sanctioned? Is there a global scientific body that agrees with this, or is this just something that the UAE and other countries in the region are doing? I'm just trying to get an idea of the status of the technology itself.
Yeah, so it's actually been around for quite a long time. So it was first developed in the 1940s and 1950s in the United States at General Electric, and they kind of dabbled with it for a while, and it kind of fell out of favor because they couldn't really prove that it worked. And then what's happened in the last 20 years is that computer modeling has gotten a lot better and our understanding of cloud physics has gotten a lot better. So now they're trying to, that's led to a revival of this cloud seeding technology. And now they're trying to prove that, yes, it actually does work. I think until recently, it's been considered something of a pseudoscience. And the jury is still out to a certain extent on whether or not it's really going to be a practical way of making rain. But I think what's changing is that people are kind of getting desperate. Countries are getting desperate. You know, they're willing to try anything because of droughts getting worse.
Sure. And when you went there on your visit, I mean, just give us an idea of what you saw yourself with your own naked eyes. What, like, was there much rain? Was did it take a while to happen? Just give us an idea of what you saw yourself.
Well, so when I went there, it didn't actually rain at all. And in fact, there weren't even that many clouds for them to seed, which is the other problem, right? You can only seed clouds that are actually there. So, you know, even if the UAE managed to...
I could just picture you ringing your editor saying, it's gone well this trip, I just haven't seen any rain. But
well, ironically, a few months after I got back, they had those massive floods, do you remember?
Yes.
In Dubai. And I was like, I really picked the wrong week to travel or the right week, if you think about it from a practical point of view. But I guess the key point is that, you know, this isn't a technology that's going to turn blue skies into, you know, buckets of rain. It's a technology where you can maybe squeeze 10% more rain out of the clouds that are already there. But if the clouds aren't there, then there's never going to be anything for you to squeeze that rain out of.
Right. So in other words, this technology will work. It's more about, you know, the yield per the effort and all the rest of it. Like, is it worth the effort is almost where the debate is. Is that fair?
Yeah. And I think there are kind of more practical ways of getting fresh water. And the UAE and other countries in the Middle East spend a lot of money on desalination, which is maybe slightly more expensive per litre than cloud seeding, but it's a lot more reliable. Like, you can guarantee that if you know, take a litre of seawater and take the salt out of it, you will have, you know, almost a litre of fresh water at the end of it. Whereas with cloud seeding, it's much more fluffy, I guess, nebulous, whether or not it's actually going to work.
Now, you took an actual cloud seeding flight run. Just walk us through what was involved in that.
Yeah, so I got an Uber to a military base in the desert.
Wired. This is where I need to go. I need to get myself a staff job at Wired, right?
Yeah. And then I went through like security, past some guys with guns, and then I got into a small propeller plane, feeling slightly nervous at that point, with a very friendly South African pilot, who then flew me up and kind of showed me like what would happen on a cloud seeding mission. So as I said, there weren't that many clouds around.
This is what would have happened if it was successful.
This is what would have happened if there'd been more clouds. So what we did was we kind of simulated what would have happened if there had actually been enough clouds for us to seed. But anyway, he took me up and we flew around kind of hunting for clouds for a while, and then we triggered the flares. So there's two different types of flares. So there's one flare that just releases salt crystals, and then there's a new flare that they developed in the UAE, which uses nano crystals. So these are salt crystals coated in other substances that make them more sticky, basically make water stick to them more easily. So that was basically what I did. And in theory, and the pilot told me that he's, you know, seen instances where he's gone up and seeded a cloud, and then, you know, 2 minutes later it started raining. But obviously, that's not science, right? You know, kind of have to like.
And as he leaned over to you and said, "Just not today."
Exactly. Yeah. So it was all sort of. It was a very interesting experience, and I think the takeaway that I took from it was that I think the UAE wants to be seen to be able to do these things. You know, it wants to be seen to be a technological superpower, and that's one of the reasons why it's investing so much money in cloud seeding when maybe desalination, taking salt out of seawater, which is maybe slightly more boring, perhaps isn't going to grab as many headlines.
And did you get a sense from talking to people there that the cloud seeding is, as you say, kind of optics to some degree, and that the bigger yields of water for the future will be the desalinations or maybe piping water from other areas or something like that? Is that sort of what the real work is? And this is sort of a little bit for the cameras and maybe even Wired magazine.
Yeah, a little bit. And I think they have invested a lot of money in research. That's the other interesting thing about the UAE, and the reason I wanted to go there specifically is that they've invested like tens of millions of dollars in trying to sort of advance the science of rain enhancement. So the flight that I just described, that's the way that cloud seeding has kind of been done since it was invented in the 1940s. But what they've started doing in the UAE is investing in things like drones and lasers and things like that, which are kind of new technologies which they hope can make it rain. So they're developing, you know,
do you know any more about when I hear the word laser, I get nervous. Do you know much more about that part?
So actually, after I went on the cloud seeding flight, I got a lift to another military base where they took my phone away, made me put it in a locker, and I wasn't allowed to record anything or take any photos. This is like super top secret stuff. Again, just feeling slightly nervous at this point. They took my passport off me as well, I think, actually. Like, I was just feeling slightly nervous at that point. So they basically have this laser, ground-based laser, that they shoot into the sky, and it turns the sky to plasma.
That doesn't sound good on the surface, way you were briefly describing it there.
Yeah, so basically what it was, so they showed me like a miniature version of it, and it was like a kind of very fine laser beam that was invisible, and then they focused it, and a very small piece of the air kind of it looked like a bit like a web of like you see a spider web like caught in a beam of light or whatever. It looked a bit like that, but it was bright blue, and there was this really loud buzzing noise, and this tiny bit of the air turned bright blue like lightning. And basically what they'd done is they'd focused this laser so powerfully that it set the that small piece of the air on fire.
Some of this is sounding a bit Timothy Leary, sort of hallucinogenic. In terms of them doing all these things, lasers and shooting all sorts of things at the sky and turning plasma as you describe it, did you get any sense that this has been run by the scientists, or is this being run by the military, or is this being run by the politicians? Like, who's driving all these sort of semi-dystopian sort of images that you're creating here? Like, who was kind of running the show here when you were walking around the place?
Yeah, so the work's being done by scientists. The funding comes from the government. A lot of the work is kind of military adjacent, so I didn't get the sense that the military were particularly involved, or I think there are probably military applications for a lot of this technology.
I suppose that would be the worry. Could all this stuff be weaponized in what's already a fairly fertile region? The idea of throwing a few extra lasers into the mix just makes me a bit spooked.
Yeah, and there's a long history of, during the Vietnam War, the US used cloud seeding to try and basically make the Ho Chi Minh Trail like soggy, so that it would be harder for, the enemy combatants to traverse it. There was a UN kind of treaty on weather modification in the 1970s that said, don't modify the weather for warfare, basically. But it's not so much, it's even, even if they can't actually make it rain, I think the perception that they could make it rain is also dangerous in and of itself. There was a story from a few years ago where an Iranian general kind of started accusing countries like the UAE and Israel of stealing Iran's rain. And you can see how something like that, even if
they can have ours here in Ireland, where we have a surplus,
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, maybe that is a solution to this problem.
and all jokes aside, I mean, it's just give people an idea who a lot of our listeners have been in this region, but a lot wouldn't have, just how dry it is and how urgent the need is. I mean, this is what's sort of propelling them into doing what we might see as slightly eccentric technologies. But just give us an idea of how dry it is and how bad climate change is impacting on this area.
Yeah, so the UAE is obviously naturally very dry, one of the driest places on Earth. And what's happened there in particular is that the population's increased and the water consumption has increased. It's got one of the highest rates of water consumption on Earth. So that's the problem that they have. What's happening with climate change, ironically, has actually probably made it wetter. And you see things like the storms that they had there in April, where a huge amount of rain was dumped on the region in a very, very short space of time. So climate change is actually probably making the whole region wetter, or at least slightly more volatile, so you kind of get more wet periods and more dry periods. I think that, one of the things that came out of after those floods was that, it's not so much that climate change caused those floods or that, cloud seeding caused those floods. It was that the region was not equipped to deal with that level of rain. So a lot of it's about, like, the choices that countries make in terms of infrastructure. The UAE is a very affluent place. It's a place that's full of polo fields and golf courses and swimming pools and, lots of things that use a lot of water. And, it would be much more efficient for them to maybe be more efficient in their water use than it would be to try and squeeze water out of the
conservation
sky.
Sure, might also play a part. I mean, there's always been this idea years ago, we used to talk about the water wars, those countries that had water would be able to sell it. Obviously, we're hoping those of us listening from the west of Ireland in particular will be saying this could be a war we might welcome. But in terms of these countries, they'll have to do something. I just hope that they're not going to put all their resources into these sort of almost unproven technologies while neglecting the other more, as you say, prosaic things like the desalinations and so on. So it sounds like from what you're saying, they're doing both, so that there is a bit of comfort in that.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, it's an energy problem, right? There is enough water for everyone in the world, but 70% of it is seawater. So if you can solve the energy problem, then you don't really have a water problem anymore. But, you know, that is very energy intensive. So then that maybe has a knock-on effect, right? If you're running your desalination plant with, you know, fossil fuels, then you're just sort of kicking the problem further down the road.
Okay, well, listen, well done on the lasers. I hope you got your passport back at the end of the whole trip.
I did, yeah.
And, it must have been quite bizarre when you go back to the airport and you just ordered a bottle of water. It seems so convenient, but other countries struggling to get it. Very much a trip worth taking, even if the water didn't come out of the sky on the particular day you visited. A good read, nevertheless. Amit Karwala, who is a writer and editor at Wired, thank you very much for talking to us through about cloud seeding and manufacturing the rain. We don't have that problem here. We've got a very good and slick manufacturing operation already. And thank you for coming to talk to us on Taking Stock.
Thank you so much.
And that indeed is it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're also, of course, available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. And also thanks to our producer, the effervescent John Fardy, Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva was on the sound. Any comment on today's items, you, of course, can email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton is up next with all your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Emmett Oliver, thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.